From Maine Public Radio and MainePublic.org, I'm Nora Flaherty, bringing you the news on this day in Maine, Friday, August 11th, 2017. And on this day, insurance on the Maine Healthcare Exchange is getting more expensive. Does that mean the fabled death spiral? And we'll meet a barrel maker or a cooper, a trade that's no longer quite as obscure as it once was. That's all ahead in just a moment.
This Day in Maine is made possible by listeners like you and by USM's Muskie School of Public Service Masters of Policy Planning and Management, preparing students to be a force for positive change in their communities.
For the second year in a row, average premiums in Maine's Affordable Care Act marketplace will see double-digit increases. Maine's insurance superintendent has approved rate hikes for 2018 plans that range from 18% to 27%. Health policy analysts say that does not mean the market is imploding, as President Trump has predicted, but they do say that Congress must take immediate action when it reconvenes in September to stabilize the market. Patty White has more.
The three insurers on the Maine ACA marketplace asked for even higher increases. But in a decision issued on Thursday, State Insurance Superintendent Eric Chapa approved rates between 2 to 5% below requests. Community Health Options was allowed to increase premiums an average of 18%, Anthem an average of 19%, Harvard Pilgrim an average of 27%. The bright side, says Steve Butterfield, policy director for Consumers for Affordable Healthcare, is that most consumers, about 86% of those on the marketplace in Maine, will be shielded from the increases.
When you receive tax credits, the premium you pay is based on your income, not necessarily what the premium is of your plan.
But those who earn too much or too little to qualify for tax credits will be forced to absorb the increases. Butterfield says the rising premiums are due to two factors: rising healthcare costs and uncertainty about the future of the ACA.
Last year was supposed to be the course correction, right? Last year was the year where, you know, insurers were really starting to figure out how this market worked. It wasn't until all this uncertainty started appearing at the federal level, you know, and the administration started making threats about, you know, undoing it from within, that you started seeing these problems.
These increases are much higher than they needed to be.
Mitchell Stein is a Maine-based independent health policy consultant. He points to three recent analyses from Standard & Poor's, the Congressional Budget Office, and the Kaiser Family Foundation that each determined the ACA market was stabilizing. But Stein agrees with Butterfield that actions by the Trump administration are disrupting that progress.
Because the law has to be implemented fully, and that's not what's occurring.
President Trump has threatened to discontinue cost-sharing reduction reimbursements to insurers, which are used to lower costs for some consumers. To prepare for that scenario, Maine insurance companies proposed and were approved for even steeper increases, 20 to 37%, if those reimbursements end. But Stein has a bigger concern: the possibility that the Trump administration won't enforce the individual mandate that requires everyone to purchase health insurance.
If the mandate were eliminated completely, then we could end up in that classic death spiral scenario, and that could undermine the market more completely than just the elimination of the CSR payments.
The death spiral is a situation where insurance premiums rise high enough that they drive away healthy consumers and leave sicker consumers. That further increases costs, creating the same scenario again and again. Both Stein and Steve Butterfield say the death spiral isn't imminent and it can be avoided, but it will take action by congressional lawmakers when they return in September to fund the cost-sharing reimbursements and to enforce the individual mandate. For Maine Public Radio News, I'm Patty White.
Maine's next general election is more than a year away, but state Democratic leaders are already strategizing on ways to reverse recent back-to-back losses in several high-profile races. One top party official and several candidates met last night with voters in East Orland for a free-range discussion on the party's strengths and its weaknesses. A.J. Higgins has more.
You know the answer to this. The Democrats filing into the Craig Brook Fish Hatchery Auditorium in East Orland occupy a range of points on the party's political spectrum. They've been invited by a group called the Maine Common Good Coalition to assess the current status of the party. Katie Mae Simpson, executive director of the Maine Democratic Party, doesn't hold back.
The Democratic Party brand is really damaged. I'm not going to pretend that it's not.
According to a Washington Post report, during the last 9 years, Democrats have lost 20% of the seats they once held in state legislatures and nearly the same percentage of seats they held in the U.S. House of Representatives. And they've lost a whopping 35% of all state governorships. Here in Maine, the numbers are less dramatic but equally deflating for the party. Republican Governor Paul LePage has rebuffed back-to-back challenges from the best candidates the party had to offer. The Maine House has downsized the number of majority Democrats it has claimed over the last two election cycles, while party leaders have watched their Democratic minority in the Maine Senate fall and rise.
The crystal ball is broken. Like, Trump's victory shattered all crystal balls. No one knows what the hell is going to happen in 2018. No one knows.
One thing that Simpson does know is that the party is staging a full-court press in Maine to win back the governor's office and try to steal a third term away from 2nd District Congressman Bruce Poliquin. To do that, Simpson says the party is off to an early start, hiring 5 organizers before Labor Day to start the ground game in motion. Flanked by several Democratic candidates for state and federal office, Simpson urged them to sell themselves to the voters rather than attack their GOP opponents.
We know that we need a reason to vote for us. What isn't going to work is saying Trump's terrible, even though we can preach to the choir about that, and Poliquin's a mess. We're not going to do that either.
Maybe what we need to talk about is what the next step is to get us into a better future.
Maine Secretary of State Matt Dunlap, who served in the Maine House as a progressive Democrat, agrees that the party should stick to positive messages about everyday issues that keep Mainers up at night.
You know, maybe talk about things like broadband, better transportation infrastructure, and energy prices. I mean, when you talk about the challenges that Maine faces, those are always a big thing.
There's only one message American voters have, and it's the economy.
Peter Templeton, a Blue Hill Democrat who attended the East Orland Forum, says Democratic candidates could advance if they appeal directly to the concerns of the voters, and he says it's really not that complicated.
The economy in Maine has never been good. You either have to maintain the status quo in Maine or you have to make it better. And you can't sit around and promise everybody big, high-paying jobs because the mills have closed down and things have gotten slow.
Jason Savage, executive director of the Maine Republican Party, would be just as happy if Democratic candidates ignored Templeton's advice. He says that when Democrats in the legislature choose to emulate the party's national leaders, such as Congresswoman Nancy Pelosi, his job gets easier.
What we see is Democrats, election cycle after election cycle, they're trying to impose San Francisco values on the elections and on the people of Maine, and it's not working.
Jim Melcher, a political science professor at the University of Maine at Farmington, says Democrats might do well to stop questioning how they deliver their message and focus more on the message itself.
I think there's a strong sense among a lot of Democrats that it's not so much we need to change as much as we need to get our message out better.
But Republican strategists, including Jason Savage, say that the voters are getting the Democratic message loud and clear, and that's been their problem. For Maine Public Radio News, I'm A.J. Higgins.
These days, Cooper might refer to a brand of cheese or a compact car. But 100 years ago, a cooper was commonly known as a person who built wooden casks to store wine, whiskey, or other consumables. And that craft is still alive. In fact, one cask maker in South Portland says business is good thanks to a renaissance in craft liquor. Jennifer Mitchell has the next installment of our series, Once Upon a Job.
If you like a nip of fine cask-aged whiskey, part of what you're enjoying is the flavor of the barrel it came in.
I use exclusively white oak. It's watertight, but it also tastes good.
Make a nasty-tasting barrel, and you've spoiled an entire batch of spirit, says Ed Luchins, who handmakes barrels for a number of craft distilleries. He locally sources his white oak from the forests of western Maine, custom mills it, and air dries it for at least 1 year for whiskey casks and at least 3 years for wine casks. And before any liquid goes inside a new oak barrel, Luchins custom flames the inside for the distiller.
The sugars in the wood start to caramelize and creates all sorts of flavors. And then in addition to the caramelizing of the sugars, the charring of the oak creates that nice smoky flavor that is prized by distillers, whiskey makers, and such.
Luchin specializes in what's known as tight coopering or wet coopering, that is, barrels that can hold fluid. There's also dry coopering for content such as potatoes, and also bucket making, which is a related trade. But Luchin says he's focused his business around supplying local beer, wine, and spirit makers with custom barrels for their handcrafted quaff. And by the way, we've all been misusing the term barrel.
The barrel actually refers to the volume, not the shape, not the thing.
Luchin says 36 imperial gallons make up a barrel. A wooden vessel designed to hold food and drink is called a cask, and they come in many more sizes than just barrel.
A pin is a 5-gallon. A firkin is a 10-gallon, which is about this size.
Luchin thumps a modest-sized oaken rum cask he's making for a customer.
Kinderkin is 18, which is half of a barrel size. And then a barrel is obviously a 36. There's hogsheads are 53, 54 gallon.
And finally, the butt, which holds about 108 gallons.
Which is just mammoth.
As he moves about the shop, the business Luchin's describes sounds very classic, old-timey even. But he's a young man, and he's only been doing it for about 4 years. Unlike many other craftspeople, he didn't apprentice with a master and then take on someone else's well-established shop.
So what's your history then? I mean, did you wake up as a 5-year-old and say, I want to be a barrel maker. I want to be a cooper.
Yeah. I did not. I spent the past 20 years or so carpentering my way around New England. I did woodworking to make my way through college and just kind of ended up in the woodworking business.
But Luchin says he was burning out. The competition was fierce, with fewer people willing to pay for custom woodworks. He was finding it a chore just to stay afloat. What he needed was a niche.
As luck would have it, I was doing some piecework for a local distiller, and they said that they were having a really hard time getting barrels, and did I think I could make a barrel?
He decided to try, but he soon discovered that his options for learning the trade were severely limited.
Unfortunately, because of the steel industry, because of Prohibition, and a couple of world wars, the coopering business pretty much dissolved in the States.
But with the help of some century-old manuals and a lot of trial and error, Luchin's finally started making barrels that didn't leak.
Initially, I made a lot of what I call barrel-shaped things, things that didn't hold liquid, but eventually I got the knack of it.
And he did it using traditional methods, with nothing but hoops and good milling to keep the cask together. No glues or nails of any kind are used. And one of the challenges, he says, was in finding a natural, classic way to seal the groove where the barrel head sits, called the crow's. He settled on an old-school wheat paste mixture to act as a sealant.
Good old King Arthur wheat flour and water. And that just helps to provide a seal for the barrel head as it sits. There's a lot of different concoctions that coopers use to seal their crows, but that's the one that I've kind of settled on.
Luchin's also traveled to Kentucky to spend some time learning more about large-scale barrel making there, where the region's bourbon and Tennessee whiskey industries have kept a very small pocket of cooperages alive. These days, Luchin's can make about 4 to 5 casks per week by himself, by hand, which he says is a lot less than the local craft distilling industry actually needs. Luchin says he knows of only about 9 master coopers left in the entire country, with several of those working for historical reenactments and living history museums. He knows of nobody else in Maine who does tight coopering, but he says there's room in the industry for a lot more. For Maine Public Radio News, I'm Jennifer Mitchell.
For more of today's Maine news, visit our website, mainepublic.org. And from Maine Public, that's This Day in Maine for Friday, August 11th, 2017. Thanks to Ed Morin and our digital team, I'm Nora Flaherty.